welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and in our appeals to heaven, you need to continue to learn and pray and act. And the whole point of the movement, or everything that we are trying to proffer, trying to suggest, is it's all about full compliance to the Constitution. That differentiates us from myopic organizations that say, well, we care about this part of the Constitution, the Second Amendment, or our religion, or health freedom, or what have you. Those are myopic. We will submit that if we all seek full compliance of the Constitution, everybody's problem goes away. So why don't we unite instead of allowing these divisive organizations and leaders who are literally out there trying to get people to, you know, come get involved in this convention of states, convention of counties? Does it matter? Why are we allowing them to basically keep us divided? United we stand, divided we fall, and they are leading us into our destruction. I can't say it any better. Hopefully that is good enough. And I think I forgot yesterday that we do want to restore our election of the president, and that we, the people, choose our electors so that we can resume actually getting the ability of actually getting a constitutional president instead of the uniparty globalists, which is what we always get. So with that, I would venture to say welcome back. And, yep. And we were in the midst of Samuel Adams kind of going through and highlighting some specific amendments that were recommended by John Hancock, the president of the convention. And we were just basically going to read the last one, which was kind of a grand jury indictment requirement. So why don't we go ahead and pick up with that now?
Okay. Your Excellencies, next proposition is to introduce the indictment of a grand jury before any person shall be tried for any crime by which he may incur infamous punishment or loss of life. And it is followed by another which recommends a trial by jury in civil actions between citizens of different states, if either of the parties shall request it. These and several others which I have mentioned are so evidently beneficial as to need no comment of mine, and they are all, in every particular, of so general a nature and so equally interesting to every state that I cannot but persuade myself to think they would all readily join with us in the measure proposed by Your Excellency, if we should now adopt it. Gentlemen may make additional propositions if they think fit. It is presumed that we shall exercise candor towards each other, and that whilst on the one hand gentlemen will cheerfully agree to any proposition intended to promote a general union, which may not be inconsistent with their own mature judgment, others will avoid the making such as may be needless or tend to embarrass the minds of the people of this commonwealth and our sister states, and thereby not only frustrate Your Excellency's wise intention, but endanger the loss of that degree of reputation which I flatter myself this commonwealth has justly sustained.
Ah, okay, so apparently, and I know a lot of people that really look up to Samuel Adams, but and it's not that he wasn't a good leader, but he was a Puritan, and he was obviously a Massachusetts or Puritan loyalist, whatever. I mean, I don't think that he, until the Constitution was again presented and he started understanding, and then this concept of these amendments, I don't think he was really on board with, you know, the ability of a central or a general government being able to have those powers. Because the Confederation, under the Articles of Confederation, the Continental Congress was impotent. And so maintaining that is just, it's hard for me to fathom why anybody would stand and say, we want to maintain this. Anybody that understands where America was literally going, and it was actually brought up in this debate, that if they don't act on this Constitution, they can kiss the Union goodbye, and that was even proffered or suggested that in the near future, the nations of Europe would start licking their chops because we wouldn't be able to pay our debt and start dividing us and conquering us. And so, I know people kind of see the big picture, but I think there were plenty of people that were in denial, not realizing the impotency of Congress and the danger. Because if Massachusetts truly thought, because obviously he says they justly sustained and, you know, they earned their reputation. I don't think Massachusetts would be able to forbear, you know, a three-nation, Britain, France, and Spain, descending upon the Americas and dividing them. In unison and in a concerted effort, attacking us. It's one thing for one nation to do it, but the amount of ferocity and force and mayhem that they could inflict upon these colonies or these states at this point in time, I think these men were in denial in some respects. And they deserve all due respect for, you know, the laurels that they built on their own. But at this juncture, at this point in time, it was, you know, I think there's an expression, it's, you know, you have to make the choice of fishing or cutting bait. You know, are you going to fish or cut bait? What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And so if they thought that just going and fishing or, you know, not ratifying the Constitution and going back to what they had, then it all would be wasted and the revolution would, you know, the lives that were spent in that were for naught, unfortunately. So Mr. Nason then comes up and he actually, this is an anti-federalist. So Mr. Nason states this. Go ahead.
Okay. When, sir, we dissolved the political bands which connected us with Great Britain, we were in a state of nature. We then formed and adopted the Confederation, which must be considered as a sacred instrument.
Okay, hold on here. Hold on here. I'm going to have to challenge. The way he's presenting this information is flawed, because he says, when we dissolved our political bands which connected us with Great Britain, we were in a state of nature when we then formed and adopted the Confederation, which must be considered as a sacred instrument. Well, hold on here. He's making this comment where they actually didn't do it that way. The Articles of Confederation weren't ratified. They didn't become legitimate. We've gone through this, right? When did they become legitimate? After the war.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have all of the states on board. And so all of the states finally, reluctantly, as they came on board, all of the states really started working in kind of undermining it. Some states honored their debt, but they still were seeking their own trade agreements. In other words, with their lips, they honored the Articles of Confederation, but with their hearts, they had removed themselves far from it. That's a biblical New Testament scripture that basically speaks of, you know, with their lips they do honor me, and with their hearts they have removed themselves far from me. And that's the same thing here. These guys like to say and applaud the Articles of Confederation, but they actually are in complete denial, and they're doing that so that they can maintain their cabal, their little source of power there in their own little state. And so, anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. This confederates us under one head as sovereign and independent states. Now, sir, if we give Congress power to dissolve that confederation, to what can we trust? If a nation consent thus to treat their most solemn compacts, who will ever trust them? Let us, sir, begin with this Constitution and see what it is. And first, we the people of the United States do, etc., if this, sir, does not go to an annihilation of the state governments and to a perfect consolidation of the whole Union, I do not know what does. What shall we consent to this? Can 10, 20, or 100 persons in this state, who have taken the oath of allegiance to it, dispense with this oath? Gentlemen may talk as they please of dispensing in certain cases with oaths, but, sir, with me they are sacred things. We are under oath. We have sworn that Massachusetts is a sovereign and independent state. How, then, can we vote for this Constitution that destroys that sovereignty?
Okay, so he basically sat down and kind of got away with that, and then Colonel Varham begged leave to set the worthy gentleman right. The very oath, he said, which the gentleman had mentioned, provides an exception for the power to be granted to Congress. Anyway, so Mr. Nason then gets back and, you know, continues to go on. And here's his next comment, which is another anti-federalist comment. Go ahead.
Okay. The eighth section, Mr. President, provides that Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, excises, etc. We may, sir, be poor. We may not be able to pay these taxes, etc. And we must have a little meal and a little meat whereon to live and save a little for a rainy day. But what follows? Let us see. To raise and support armies. Here, sir, comes the key to unlock this cabinet. Here's the means by which you will be made to pay taxes. But will ye, my countrymen, submit to this? Suffer me, sir, to say a few words on the fatal effects of standing armies, that bane of republican governments. A standing army. Was it not with this that Caesar passed the Rubicon and laid prostrate the liberties of this country? By this have 7/8 of the once free nation of the globe been brought into bondage. Time would fail me were I attempt to recapitulate the havoc made in the world by standing armies. Britain attempted to enforce her arbitrary measures by a standing army. But, sir, we had patriots then who alarmed us of our danger, who showed us the serpent and bade us beware of it. Shall I name them? I fear I shall offend your excellency, but I cannot avoid it. I must. We had a Hancock, an Adams, and a Warren. Our sister states, too, produced a Randolph, a Washington, a Greene, and a Montgomery, who led us in our way. Some of these have given up their lives in defense of the liberties of their country. And my prayer to God is that when this race of illustrious patriots shall have bid adieu to the world from their dust, as from the sacred ashes of the phoenix, another race may arise, who shall take our posterity by the hand, and lead them to trample on the necks of those who shall dare to infringe on their liberties. Sir, had I a voice like Job, maybe? I don't know what that...
I don't know either, Jove. I don't know the context.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. I would proclaim it throughout the world. And had I an arm like Jove, I would hurl from the globe those villains that would dare attempt to establish in our country a standing army. I wish, sir, that the gentlemen of Boston would bring to their minds the fatal evening of the 5th of March, 1770, when by standing troops they lost 5 of their fellow townsmen. I will ask them, what price can atone for their lives? What money can make satisfaction for the loss? The same causes produce the same effects. An army may be raised on pretense of helping a friend, or many pretenses might be used. That night, sir, ought to be sufficient warnings against standing armies, except in cases of great emergency. They are too frequently used for no other purpose than dragooning the people into slavery. But I beseech you, my countrymen, for the sake of your posterity, to act like those worthy men who have stood forth in defense of the rights of mankind, and show to the world that you will not submit to tyranny. What occasion have we for standing armies? We fear no foe. If one should come upon us, we have a militia, which is our bulwark. Let Lexington witness that we have the means of defense among ourselves. If during the last winter there was not much alacrity shown by the militia in turning out, we must consider that they were going to fight their countrymen. Do you, sir, suppose that, had a British army invaded us at that time, such subpoenas would have been discovered? No, sir, to our enemies' dismay and discomfort, they would have felt the contrary, but against deluded, infatuated men, they did not wish to exert their valor or their strength. Therefore, sir, I am utterly opposed to a standing army in time of peace.
Okay, so let me interject real quick. He basically, this is what he says regarding this a standing army, what he says about the federalizing the militia into a standing army. He said, the same causes produce the same effects. An army may be raised on pretense of helping a friend, or many pretenses might be used. Well, what are the pretenses that he's referring to? Because the Constitution dictates that the federal government can only call forth the militia from the states to do three things: to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress an insurrection, you know, turmoil within the states, you know, an uprising, and to repel invasions. Don't understand this concept of the pretense of helping a friend or other pretenses. It's clear they can only do these three things. But he's making the assumption that, oh, I don't know what it says, and so I'm going to be ignorant and say they can call it forth for anything. No. This goes back to how is it enumerated. These are the three objects that they can call forth the militia away from the states. That's it. So what he's doing is he's using hyperbole in trying to support an argument that actually defies the language of the Constitution. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is how, when you really look at the Anti-Federalists, they were willing to say anything. And as a matter of fact, I would have loved to see whoever followed up with this. He goes, sir, you're saying that the Constitution will allow them, will allow the federal government to do that? Well, if they do that, it's our responsibility to hold them accountable to the language in the Constitution that you can't call forth, right, and we will not deliver this militia for the pretenses of supporting a friend. The Constitution doesn't allow you to deploy our army or the federalized militia beyond the borders of this nation. Had everybody just focused on these enumerations, but the Anti-Federalists had to reach, they had to concoct, they had to fabricate circumstances and conditions that were direct violations of the Constitution, and they got away with it way too many times in the ratification debates. I would have loved to have that. There you go again. You have no credibility. Every time you open your mouth, you lie. Because what you're saying is a direct violation to the Constitution. They can't do those things. And you're saying they're just going to do it. Anyway, does that make sense? So this is why the Bill of Rights and wanting a Bill of Rights would have actually just, and what it did was it literally got everybody to focus on the amendments and not understand what the government was actually created to do. And so when we look at people today and you ask them, because I've seen this so many times, you know, the idiots on the street, right? You know, this wandering reporter, hey, what's the most important part of the Constitution? I would say Article 7. And I would explain why. But most people say, oh, the right to bear arms. That's not a part of the Constitution. That's an amendment that they can't, you know, they can't get involved in the, you know, the people's right to bear arms. So, anyway, I'm just trying to, you know, feel better about, you know, actually, I know that the Bill of Rights have an important role, but I believe that they became the easy excuse for people to become lazy.
Okay. Never thought about it like that.
Right. Okay, so let's go on.
Makes sense. All right, the paragraph that gives Congress the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus claims a little attention. This is a great bulwark, a great privilege indeed. We ought not, therefore, to give it up on any slight pretense. Let us see, how long is it to be suspended? As long as rebellion or invasion shall continue? This is exceeding loose. Why is not the time limited, as is our Constitution? But, sir, its design would then be defeated. It was the intent, and by it, we shall give up one of our greatest privileges.
Right.
Mr. N. concluded by saying he had much more to say, but as the House were impatient, he should sit down for the present to give other gentlemen an opportunity to speak.
Yeah, sit down and shut up. So, this was clarified, and they may not have clarified it very well in Massachusetts, even though they were, quote-unquote, the shining star of the Revolutionary War. Obviously, they didn't understand the modes and mechanisms of the militia and deployment and so forth, as well as Virginia, because Virginia, when we get to that, Virginia literally lays it out that the writ of habeas corpus, or the what they call martial law, because that's what, when you suspend it, that's when it goes hand in hand with declaring martial law. They cannot declare martial law broadly throughout the United States. As it was defined in Virginia, it can only be declared where the militia is deployed, not to, you know, the areas of the United States that's not under invasion or not under an insurrection. It's very focused and limited to where it is necessary. But there have been people that have actually purported, and there is actually a tyrant called Lincoln who declared martial law to be basically deployed throughout all of the states in the Union. In other words, he was using tyranny and not how the Constitution was defined and the principles of the Constitution. So anyway, so Judge Sumner speaks, blah, blah, blah. We keep going and going down. And now we get to Reverend Thatcher. And I believe that this is where he goes through this long dissertation. So this is a long one. And we've got maybe a minute and a half to kind of cover the lengthiness of this. And so why don't we just wait till we come back from the break to okay. dive into this? Because this is where I think people... where he actually puts, I think, the spiritual eyes on the Constitution that I think really resonates with most of the people. Because if anything, the people of Massachusetts being Puritans definitely had a far more spiritual perspective of things, where they may have understood Montesquieu, they may have understood some of these things, but not everybody. And so anyway... with that, so that makes sense to you regarding, you know, the militia and these far-fetched comments by the Anti-Federalists. So, you know, that's why I try to highlight which of these guys are Anti-Federalists, because I don't want people to be confused when we read these things. Well, that doesn't sound in favor of the Constitution. That sounds like they're against it, and they are.
Right.
These guys are arguing. In other words, legally, what was happening as the proponents, the Federalists, were basically selling and helping everybody understand what the Constitution really meant, the Anti-Federalists were trying to throw wrenches into the mix. They were trying to, you know, put a stick in the spokes of the bicycle to overturn it. They were literally trying to make any type of comment that would frustrate the ratification. But bottom line, as this went forward into the final vote for ratification, their concepts, what they were asserting, was rejected, and the body of delegates for each of the states basically accepted the Constitution as stipulated. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me lead in with the paragraph that separates, or you know, where you're gonna take off from the note right there. So
okay.
This is what the good Reverend Thatcher says. There are three circumstances which deserve notice in considering the subject. These are the necessity that all the states have in some general bond of union, the checks upon government in the form offered for our adoption, and lastly, the particular disadvantages to which we shall be exposed if we reject it. Now he goes on to these things of the three considerations. So go ahead and lead away.
Okay, with respect to the first of these considerations, I trust there is no man in his senses but what will own that the whole country hath largely felt the want of energy in the general government. While we were at war with Britain, common danger produced a common union, but the cause being removed, the effect ceased also. Nay, I do not know, but we may safely add that the union produced by uniform danger was still inadequate to general and national purposes. This commonwealth, with a generous, disinterested regard to the good of the whole, appeared foremost in the day of danger. At the conclusion of the late war, 2/3 of the Continental Army were from Massachusetts. Their provision and their clothing proceeded, also in a great measure, from our extraordinary exertions. People did this in the fullest confidence that with peace and tranquility were restored from the honor and justice of our sister states, our supernumerary expenses would be abundantly repaid. But alas, how much hath our expectation been blasted? The Congress, though willing, yet had no power to do us justice. The small district of Rhode Island put a negative upon the collected wisdom of the continent. This was done not by those who are patrons of their present infamous system of paper currency, but by that part of them who now call themselves honest men. We have made exertions to stop the importation of foreign luxuries. Our brethren in the neighboring states, from the view of local advantages, have taken occasion to distress us upon the same account. They have encouraged where we have prohibited, and by those iniquitous measures have made our virtue and public spirit an additional cause of our calamity. Nor have our calamities been local. They have reached to all parts of the United States and have produced dissipation and indigence at home and contempt in foreign countries. On the one hand, the haughty Spaniards... that's funny. The haughty Spaniards has deprived us of the navigation of the river Mississippi. On the other, The British nations are, by extravagant duties, running our fishery. Our sailors are enslaved by the pirates of Algiers. Our credit is reduced to so low an ebb that American faith is a proverbial expression for perfidy, as Punic faith was among the Romans. Thus have we suffered every species of infamy abroad and poverty at home. Such, in fact, have been our calamities as are enough to convince the most skeptical among us of the want of a general government in which energy and vigor should be established, and at the same time, the rights and liberties of the people preserved.
So here, what you just read, he doesn't point to France and the other parts of Europe that were shipping in the fine goods that Massachusetts was trying to ban, where these other states were embellishing. And he points to how the Spaniards already were, you know, creating chaos by blocking access to the Mississippi, and how the British were directly affecting them in Massachusetts. And as a matter of fact, you know, he points out that, you know, Massachusetts being two-thirds of the army when the war finally ended, and that they were basically carrying the burden and carrying that debt that the nation owed them, that money. And so, you know, what he's doing is he's laying out, you know, these conditions that really prove that the Articles of Confederation were impotent in being able to restore, you know, their investments or to repay them for their contributions to the war and so forth and so on. So, and also when we look at the current conditions with the Spain and Britain and what they were doing, and the, again, Articles of Confederation impotent in trying to enforce anything. Right? Were they going to declare war against Spain for the harassments of access, or the same thing with the harassments of the fisheries? That wasn't, there was no way that the Union would have actually been in favor of declaring war for navigation of the Mississippi, because what state bordered the Mississippis at this point in time? There were territories. Yeah. There wasn't any of these states that actually needed the direct access. They just saw that it was inhibiting the growth of the territories. So would Continental Congress be able to convince the states to go to war to actually, you know, open up the navigation of the Mississippi? Heck no. None of the states and the delegates in Continental Congress would be able to declare war. And it's the same thing with Britain's, you know, direct involvement in the northeastern fisheries. They weren't involved in the rest of the state's fisheries because they didn't have cod fisheries like they did up there. So these were all local or regional problems that he was pointing out, that because they don't have a federal government, or because they don't have this union with energy, I should say, that could actually do things like declare war and actually tax the other states to repay them their debt. So go ahead, go on. It's okay. Interesting. He's giving you a snapshot of really how the conditions right now. Go ahead.
Yeah. A constitution hath been presented to us, which was composed and planned by men who in the council and field have in the most conspicuous offices served their county in the late war. It comes authenticated by a man who, without any pecuniary reward, commanded our army and who retired to a private station with more pleasure than he left it. I do not say, Mr. President, that this proves the form of government to be perfect, or that it is an unanswerable argument that we should adopt it, but it is a reason why we should examine it with care and caution, and that we ought not rashly and precipitately to reject it. It will be objected there are more powers granted than are necessary, and that it tends to destroy the local governments of the particular states, and that it will eventually end either an
aristocracy.
Aristocracy or despotism. To answer the objection, two considerations should be taken into view: the situation of the continent when a constitution was formed, and the impossibility of preserving a perfect sovereignty in the states after necessary powers were ceded to a supreme council of the whole. As to the first, let us candidly examine the state of these republics from New Hampshire to Georgia and see how far vigor and energy were required. During the session of the late convention, Massachusetts was on the point of civil war. In Vermont and New Hampshire, a great disaffection to their several governments prevailed among the people. New York absolutely refused, complying with the requisitions of Congress. In Virginia, armed men endeavored to stop the courts of justice. In South Carolina, creditors by law were obliged to receive bared and useless lands for contracts made in silver and gold. I pass over the instance of Rhode Island. Their conduct was notorious. In some states, laws were made directly against the Treaty of Peace. In others, statutes were enacted which clashed directly against any federal union. In some states, laws were made directly against the Treaty of Peace. In others, statutes were enacted which clashed directly and against any federal union. New land sufficient to discharge a great part of the continental debt intruded upon by needy adventurers, our frontier settlements exposed to the ravages of the Indians, while the several states were unable or unwilling to relieve their distress. Lay all those circumstances together, and you will find some apology for those gentlemen who framed this Constitution. I trust you may charitably assign other motives for their conduct than a design to enslave their country and to parcel out for themselves its honors and emoluments.
Okay, so he's basically saying these men walked away with no reward for what they did in creating the Constitution. But he gives you an even more detailed snapshot of how each of the states were really in the muck and mire and were having nothing but problems. And their lack of conformity to the Articles of Confederation. Again, I cannot fathom how anybody today, you know, can actually look with any luster in their eyes to the Articles of Confederation, because the only way they can is they have to ignore the stark reality that it was a flawed, impotent document. And these men are creating clearly the case of why the Constitution really was not only necessary, it was expedient for the survival of the Union, and actually it was necessary for what I would say as the gold standard in governing all nations of the world. So let's go on.
The second consideration deserves its weight. Can these local governments be sufficient to protect us from foreign enemies or from disaffection at home? 13 states are formed already. The same number are probably to be formed from the lands not yet cultivated. Of the former, yet smaller divisions may be made. The province of Maine hath desired a separation. In time, a separation may take place. Who knows but what the same may happen with respect to the old colony of Plymouth? Now, conceive the number of states increased, their boundaries lessened, their interests clashing, how easy a prey to a foreign power, how liable to war among themselves. Let these arguments be weighed, and I dare say, sir, there is no man but what would conceive that a coercive power over the whole, searching through all parts of the system, is necessary to the preservation and happiness of the whole people. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is in Britain coercion.
Mm-hmm.
But I readily grant all these reasons are not sufficient to surrender up the essential liberties of the people. But do we surrender them? This Constitution hath been compared both by its defenders and opponents to the British government. In my view of it, there is a great difference. In Britain, the government is said to consist of three forms: monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. But in fact, it is but a few removes from absolute despotism. In the crown is vested the power of adding at pleasure to the second branch, of nominating to all the places of honor and emolument, of purchasing by its immense revenues the suffrages of the House of Commons. The voice of the people is but the echo of the king, and their boasted privileges lie entirely at his mercy. In this proposed form, each branch of power is derived either immediately or directly from the people. The lower house are elected directly by those persons who are qualified to vote for the representatives of the state, and at the expiration of 2 years become private men unless their past conduct entitles them to a future election. The Senate are elected by the legislatures of the different states and represent their sovereignty.
Okay, right there. That last line. The Senate are elected by the legislatures of the different states and represent their sovereignty. So what he just said is that the whole purpose of the Senate, which the 17th Amendment didn't touch, the purpose of the Senate was to provide the suffrage for the state so they could guard the state sovereignty, i.e. the state legislature. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. These powers are a check on each other and can never be made either dependent on one another or independent of the people. The president is chosen by the electors who are appointed by the people. The high courts of justice arise from the president and senate, but yet the ministers of them can be removed only upon bad behavior. The independence of judges is one of the most favorable circumstances to public liberty, for when they become the slaves of a venal, corrupt court and the hirelings of tyranny, all property is precarious and personal security at an end. A man may be stripped of all his possessions and murdered without the forms of law. Thus it appears that all parts of the system arise ultimately from the people and are still independent of each other. There are other restraints which, though not directly named in this Constitution, yet are evidently discerned by every man of common observation. These are the government of the several states and the spirit of liberty in the people. Are we wronged or injured? Our immediate representatives are those to whom we ought to apply. Their power and influence will still be great, but should any servants of the people, however eminent their stations, attempt to enslave them, from this spirit of liberty, such opposition would arise as would bring them to the scaffold. But admitting that there are dangers in accepting this general government, are there not great hazards in rejecting it? Such is, Mr. President, the state of our affairs, that it is not in our power to carve for ourselves. To avoid the greatest and choose the least of these two evils is all that we can do. What, then, will be the probable effects of this Constitution if this Constitution be rejected? Have we not reason to fear new commotions in this Commonwealth? If they arise, can we be always certain that we shall be furnished with a citizen who, though possessed of extensive influence and the greatest abilities, will make no other use of them than to quiet the tumult of the people, to prevent civil war, and to restore the usual course of law and justice? Are we not in danger from other states when their interests or prejudices are opposite to ours? And in such scenes of hostile contention, will not some... Will not some Scylla drench the land in blood, or some Cromwell or Caesar lay our liberties prostrate at his feet? Will not foreign nations attack us in our weak, divided condition, or once more render us provinces to some potentate of Europe?
Right.
Or will those powers to whom we are indebted lie quiet? They certainly will not. They are now waiting for our decision, but when they once see our union is broken and that we are determined to neglect them, they will issue out letters of marque and reprisal and entirely destroy our commerce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so basically, you know, he's basically saying that we can't afford to ignore and not ratify this. Doing nothing means that this is going to happen. In other words, doing nothing means that all these nations that are watching us fail are going to see that we rejected an opportunity to succeed and we've maintained the status quo of failure. The question is this a formula? Does this Constitution give us a formula of success? And the reason why they're against it is because the federal government has the powers to coerce the states to pay foreign debt. to actually make, you know, good with all of its states' promises. And the states, as they continually undermine and backdoor the Articles of Confederation, they're only exacerbating the problem and the concern with these other states looking at, hey, you guys owe us money, and you're not even following the Confederation that you created.
Mm-hmm.
So let's keep going. Go ahead.
Okay. If this system is broken up, will 13 or even 9 states ever agree to another? That's a good question. And will Providence smile on a people who despise the privileges put into their hands and who neglect the plainest principles of justice and honesty? After all, I by no means pretend that there is complete perfection in this proposed constitution. Like all other human productions, it hath its faults. Provision is made for an amendment whenever, from practice, it is found oppressive. I would add the proposals which His Excellency hath condescended to lay before this honorable convention respecting future alterations are real improvements for the better, and we have no reason to doubt that they will be equally attended to by other states as they lead to common security and preservation. Some of the gentlemen in the opposition have quoted ancient history and applied it to the question now under debate. They have shown us the danger which arises from vesting magistrates with too much power. I wish they had gone on to tell the whole truth. They might have shown how nearly licentiousness and tyranny are allied. And they who will not be governed by reason must submit to force that demagogues in all free governments have at first held out an idea of extreme liberty and have seized on the rights of the people under the mask of patriotism. They might have shown us a republic in which wisdom, virtue, and order were qualities for which a man was liable to banishment, and on the other hand, boasting, sedition, and falsehood, the sure road to honor and promotion.
Okay, so in the paragraph above, you know, he kind of leads to this, you know, this point that, hey, if we at least do this, we can at least amend it and not have to worry about Rogue Island to keeping us from being able to get amendments passed. At least we can get amendments passed. And then he goes into, you know, this basic, you know, argument that, you know, they're better off with that. And he points out that, you know, this whole point of monarchy, these are destructive. What it ends up leading to, like he says, the extravagance or the licentiousness, the tyranny, mm-hmm. the arbitrary laws that come along with that. And the demagogues are those who use vitriol. They have a negative campaign. Obama was a demagogue. Most people run demagoguery campaigns because they just point out how bad this guy is. They don't offer, you know, clear leadership solutions and so forth to say, this is what we need to be doing, and this guy doesn't get it. Instead, they just try to get everybody to hate the guy in office so that they vote for you instead, without any solutions really being offered. And so that's, mm-hmm. Aristotle pointed out in the Book of Politics that whenever tumultuous times come and revolution comes, it is demagogues, because people are in a hurry to try to fix this, you know, this tumultuous government that is, you know, going, you know, sideways quickly. They want to get mm-hmm. it contained before it gets so far out of hand it destroys everything. So demagogues quickly come to the forefront and they all throw out, you know, this bad picture of these people, and whoever makes the best argument is the guy that actually gets to inherit the mess that it will probably be continued. They never really are out to solve the problems. They're just out to seek power. That's what demagogues do. They seek power. So anyway, let's go ahead with the next one.
Okay. I'm sorry that it hath been hinted by some gentlemen in this house as if there were a combination of the rich the learned, and those of liberal professions to establish and support an arbitrary form of government. Far be it from me to retort so uncharitable and unchristian a suggestion. I doubt not but the gentlemen who are of different sentiments from myself are actuated by the purest motives. Some of them I have the pleasure to be particularly acquainted with and can safely pronounce them to be men of virtue and honor. They have no doubt a laudable concern for the liberties of their country, but I would beg them to remember that extreme jealousy and suspicion may be as fatal to freedom as security and negligence. Mm-hmm. The respect to myself, I am conscious of no motive which guides me in this great and solemn question, but what I could justify to my own heart, both on the bed of death and before the tribunal of omnipotence. I am a poor man. I have the feelings of a poor man. If there are honors and emoluments in this proposed constitution, I shall, by my profession and circumstances in life, be forever excluded from them. It is my wish and prayer that in the solemn verdict we are very soon to pronounce, we may be directed to that measure which will be for the glory, freedom, and felicity of our country, of my country.
Okay. All right. So, again, that was Reverend Thatcher. Now, Major Lusk comes up and he makes a couple comments. And then... and actually, I'll just kind of go over this. You know, he basically talks about turning from the subject of amendments. The major entered largely into the consideration of the ninth section and in the most pathetic and feeling manner described the miseries of the poor natives of Africa who are kidnapped and sold for slaves. So anyway, he goes through this and he basically talks about, as he ends it up, a popery and the Inquisition may be established in America under this Constitution. So he's using demagoguery regarding the Constitution, as he doesn't really say anything specifically and keeping it in context to the enumerations. In other words, because of this particular enumeration, it gives, you know, like, call forth the militia, because that enumeration doesn't specify why they're calling it forth to execute the laws, repel, and suppress. In other words, if they didn't have those things, and he says, okay, because they have the ability to call forth the militia, that right there could be a huge, you know, insult and danger to the Union. But it's not ambiguous like that. And they use these ambiguities to sling criticism to the Constitution. And as I said this before, the anti-federalists get away with this stuff. They've been given this latitude to basically poke, poke, poke without really coming forward with hard, tangible facts and evidence of getting into the real context of the language to say, this is why this is flawed. They can't do that. Anyway, so we're out of time, and thank you so much for your contributions.
You're welcome.
Great, and I know that some of the language, actually some of the languages of modern time, but I know some of the language is kind of hard because the way they speak. But you know, in Tammy's credit, she quickly adjusts from the huts to the butts. In other words, there was a word that was mistyped to hut, and she said but. She got that correct, and that's helpful when you can actually make sense of what that. So, in as a conviction, she's getting it. We'll be back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
And you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.